I'm delighted now to welcome back to the show Jeffrey West. He's distinguished professor and past president at the Santa Fe Institute. He is hosting an event at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts, here in Santa Fe. It's part of their Science on the Screen series. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Nice to be here with you again.
Nice to be here, too. Now, everybody else has chosen some film. You are actually have chosen all kinds of films and clips of films.
Indeed.
About cities.
And this, I must admit, was an accident in the sense that the original idea was indeed to pair a film with a scientist. And that's what I thought I'd bought into. And then we realized there wasn't really a film, but rather that there are a multiplicity of films covering a whole spectrum of ideas that are associated with cities and urbanization that could fit in very well. And so this developed into something a little bit different than the other ones in the series, that it will be, in fact, a kind of introductory presentation about cities and the role of cities and the most important message, the critical role that cities are playing in the future of kind of humanity, so to speak, and using films, both feature kind of films, narrative films, many of which the audience will know, to illustrate some of the points, but also a few documentaries, and some are visionary and some are just social commentary.
Now, a lot of your work relates to scaling, mm-hmm. and let's talk for a moment about what the word even means. Mm-hmm. What is scaling, and how does it really... Give us an example from biological life.
Sure. So scaling really is just a generic word for kind of responding to the question, what happens if I scale up some system? And you asked about biology, so you could ask the question, in what sense is an elephant a blown-up mouse? I mean, or in what sense are the whole group of mammals that go from a tiny shrew through mice and elephants, and indeed human beings all the way up to whales, scaled versions of one another in a predictive way? All mammals, after all, use the same kind of physics and chemistry, the same organizational principles. They kind of follow the same life history events, so to speak, in terms of, you know, birth, growth, maturity, production of offspring to children. Are there any rules underlying that, any systematic rules that underlie how you would scale? For example, you tell me some properties of a mouse, could I then predict what the properties of an elephant would be? So that's the kind of, putting it in more scientific framework, kinds of questions that are asked under this kind of umbrella.
So it turns out that you can't actually have a giant hamster.
That's right. Well, a giant hamster, funnily enough, does work, and I will tell you in a sense how that happens. But it is indeed, you know, what is it that is allowed by the constraints of scaling, and there is an underlying theoretical framework for that. There's an underlying scientific framework that is quantitative and put into mathematical terms and is predictive, and it allows you to answer questions like that, and in particular even ask questions. You know, the one that I will talk about briefly in this lecture or in this presentation is the question that occurs in many science fiction films of giant ants or and so on, and there you can't actually have giant ants. You can't have insects that are very, you know, humongously big. That kind of design, that evolved design, is such that those cannot actually do two things. They can't support themselves because of gravity. Their body weight.
They can't
scales.
Walk on the underside.
They wouldn't better do the kinds of things that, you know, you see them do in those science fiction movies. That's impossible. You can only do it if you're a tiny, weeny insect, but you can't do it if you're a great big insect. And secondly, more importantly, you actually, with that design, can't get enough oxygen to be supported. So often I'm asked about, you know, a question like the one you asked, and I turn it around the following way. If you ask, you know, could there be tiny elephants? And the answer is, yes, there are tiny elephants, actually. They're called mice. I mean, that's what mice are, is satisfying the same rules that elephants satisfy responding to the pressures of natural selection in their evolutionary processes. You know, had they responded to ones that had made them be small, they would have actually been mice, and that's what mice are. They have responded to them in order to be small and to deal with the kinds of problems at that scale. So there are these bunch of very systematic, surprisingly regular rules that transcend all of biology, not just across organisms, but also within organisms, you know, within cells, but also within ecosystems. So the whole extraordinary range of and diversity of biological organisms and systems.
As an animal's weight goes up, you've got a mouse that weighs a few ounces and you've got an elephant that weighs a few tons, you have a change in the metabolic rate as well.
Sure. So that metabolic rate was the first physiological process that was measured in this way, looking systematically across all organisms, and it was discovered already 70-odd years ago or more that this scaled in a very systematic way, and so that if you knew the metabolic rate of any mammal, for example, you actually knew to, you know, 80-90% accuracy, the metabolic rate on the average for any mammal. And one of the things that was discovered in that was something called an economy of scale, namely the bigger the mammal, the less energy is needed to support its individual cell. So put it slightly differently, if you doubled the size of a mammal, you would think you would double, well, you do, you double, roughly speaking, the number of cells. And so you would therefore think you would double the amount of energy you need to support it, the double amount of food it needs in order to sustain it. But in fact, the rule is that when you double the size of a mammal, instead of needing twice the amount of food per day to stay alive, you only need 75% more. And so the bigger the animal, systematically, the less energy it needs per, you know, ounce of tissue or per cell to stay alive.
So these are economies of scale, and that's the kind of terminology that we have in economics. And it turns out that some of the same laws that apply to exactly what you're talking about in biological life also apply to cities and to corporations.
Yes. So
what does that look like?
Yeah, so this is kind of amazing, really, because if you go back to the animals first, and not just animals, but it's true also of plants and trees and so forth, we have this kind of systematic behavior where once you tell me the size, its mass, its weight, you know, I can tell you pretty much everything about it in terms of its physiology and its life history events to this kind of 85-90% accuracy. And the theoretical underpinnings of that is that all life is sustained by networks. The obvious ones being circulatory systems and respiratory systems and neural systems and so on. And the theoretical framework, it relies on the idea that it is these networks that, and it is the mathematical and physical properties of these networks and their universal kinds of behaviors that give rise to these scaling laws. And so now we move over to your question about cities and corporations. You realize these too are network systems. You know, you immediately think of a city or what its roads and its electrical lines and water lines and so forth.
That resemble circulatory
systems. That have very similar. In fact, we use often the same terminology. You know, the arterial system is used both for cities and for mammals, for example. So, and we often do use, in fact, biological metaphors when we talk about social organizations. But there's one new aspect that cities have in terms of a network that is almost non-existent in biology, and that is social network. What we're doing now, in fact, the fact that I'm talking to you and this is being broadcast and people are listening, so there's this kind of information flow, and that's all part of a very large and complex network.
You don't have that in monkey systems or something.
Well,
like
you
that?
Have. There are, of course, there are animals that are communal. There are herds, and there are groups, and we have social insects, and in fact they do have kind of systematic kind of rules, but they're very simple compared to the kinds of complexity that have evolved among human beings, beginning presumably when human beings discovered and evolved language so that we could communicate, and out of that grew social organization, grew communities, and then ultimately cities and all the other kinds of organizations we're familiar with. But in particular, one of the things that we evolved was social structure, you know, beginning obviously with family and the interaction among families and the various groupings, but all governed by the kind of dyadic, the one-on-one interaction that occurs. And so, you know, we believe that underlying the functionality of cities is the interaction of human beings, and indeed one of the most important aspects of cities, in fact the most important aspect, is they are places to facilitate human interaction. They're not the buildings and the roads and so on. They're there to facilitate interaction. And going to your question, one of the remarkable things, I think, that was discovered by my colleagues and myself was that there are these systematic rules that cities also scale. That is, that just as in biology, even though the whale lives in the ocean and the elephant has a trunk and the giraffe a long neck and we walk on 2 feet, etc., these superficial differences, in fact, we are scaled versions of one another following mathematical rules. So it is that New York is a scaled version of Chicago, which is a scaled version of San Francisco, which is a scaled version of Santa Fe, even though they appear quite unique and they have their own unique geography, history, and culture. Yet, at the kind of 80 to 90% level, if you look at any quantifiable metric, whether it is the infrastructure like roads and electrical lines, or whether it is socioeconomic kinds of quantities that involve interaction like wages and the production of patents or the number of AIDS cases or the amount of crime, all of these things scale systematically with the size of the city, so much so that, again, on the average, you tell me the size of a city in the United States and we can tell you, you know, at this kind of 80, 90% level, how many police it should have, how many patents, how many AIDS cases, what the length of the road should be, etc. And we also believe that underlying it are these kind of generic, universal structures of social networks.
What's interesting, I mean, you talk about Santa Fe. Here we are in the middle of Santa Fe. We're talking, by the way, to Jeffrey West of the Santa Fe Institute. In some ways, we don't really conform to those numbers in the sense that we probably have, I mean, we do have more independent bookstores than they have in Boston, and we do have more culture and theater goers and symphonies and things like that than they have in many big cities. So there are some funny anomalies.
Yes. So this is a very important point. So going back to the scaling laws, so these scaling laws mean on the average. So this is kind of averaging over the whole urban system of the United States, for example, beginning with New York as the largest city, all the way down to the smallest towns and so forth. So one of the most interesting things is to ask exactly your question. If you take any individual town or city, how does it deviate from kind of its expected value relative to this scaling curve on these various metrics? So Santa Fe, you've already mentioned, is clearly an outlier in certain things. You know, obviously in terms of art galleries, probably in terms of, you know, the number of musical performances and so on. So there are various things that it would outperform. In the same way that you would expect if you went to San Jose, which includes Silicon Valley, you'd expect it to outperform on the number of patents being produced and so forth. So those things really are the quantifiable metrics and characteristics that are reflective of the city's individuality, geography, culture, and history. But the point to recognize that these individualities, which is where we kind of see the character of the city, are on top of this enormous baseline, which is kind of 85% of what the city is about, which is, you know, what makes a city a city: the people, their interactions, the roads, their functionality, and the general buzz.
What's amazing, I mean, we can't show these graphs on the radio, but whenever you give a lecture, you show just a basic graph with an X and a Y axis and a diagonal line going from left to right going up. And whether you're talking about biological life or whether you're talking about a city and some of the characteristics of that city or whether you're talking about a company, these economies of scale are happening, which leads to the question, is a city an organism? Is it an ecosystem? What is it?
Yeah, so one of first of all, I want to congratulate you on doing your homework. But which you always do, I guess, when I listen to you, I'm very impressed. You know, in the beginning of this work, one of the kind of driving questions was, are cities, just a part of biology, so to speak? Do they satisfy the same kind of rules and laws of biology? And biology, of course, is driven by natural selection, Darwinian evolution, and that gave rise to the extraordinary complexity and diversity we see. And imposed on that, from this viewpoint, are some constraints which are due to the fact that you have these network systems in order for each organism or each ecosystem to function. And so that kind of framework very naturally goes over to cities, in the sense that you could imagine cities are evolving by some kind of evolutionary, I'll call it competitive process, but clearly it's part of the drivers, in fact, of the socioeconomic system we live in. And then the question is, you know, is the same dynamic that occurred in biology, from which cities evolved, at work, in fact, in cities? Well, we've already talked about the infrastructure, and that does look somewhat like biology. In biology, we said there was an economy of scale. Instead of doubling the amount of energy you need, for example, when you double the size, you only need 75% in biology. In cities, it turns out, on the average, and this is kind of a global phenomenon, if you double the size of the cities, you only need 85% as many gas stations or 85% as many as much roads.
So and you probably need a lot fewer washing machines because everybody on your floor uses the same one.
Yes, exactly. So that's the point of economy of scale, is that you don't need to kind of double up everything every time you double the size. However, so that's very much like biology. But the thing that is new, so to speak, that evolved presumably with 5,000 to 10,000 years ago with the evolution of cities, is that what we see for these socioeconomic quantities, the things that involve interaction of human beings like wages and patents and AIDS cases and so forth, we find that the bigger you are, the more you have per capita. So the bigger the city, the higher the wages per capita typically, the more police. More patents are produced.
The more crime.
Exactly. So all these things go up, and what is remarkable, they seem to go up in a similar fashion. So if you double the size of a city, instead of just getting twice the wages or twice the length of roads and so on, or twice the number of patents, what you find is you produce actually 115% of the wages, 115 times as many patents, but you also get 115% times as many cases of AIDS, crime, and so on the average, again. So there's this kind of enhancement coming about because of the multiplicative nature of the interactions among human beings. And that, of course, is part of what has served us so well, because, as I mentioned earlier, in a certain sense, the whole point of cities is to bring people together in more dense situations, to get them to interact, to create ideas, to innovate, and create wealth. And that is what has led to this, you know, the extraordinary increase in standard and quality of life, especially in the developed world.
Now, one of the things that I find fascinating is, for somewhat similar reasons, you also have these economies of scale in corporations. So you have a company with three people, and then you have a company with 3,000 people, and you can put these graphs up and have the same lines that represent wealth and productivity and so on. Cities never die. Corporations always die. There's very few corporations that last even 50 years. What's the difference?
Well, that's a, you know, that's a question we're working on. And I should say, as I said earlier, this work is done primarily at the Sanofi Institute. And it's I would like to mention, while I have the opportunity, the people that are really doing the work. And the major player is Luis Bettencourt, who's a young physicist who's turned his attention to these questions, and a couple of young postdocs. One is a man named Marcus Hamilton, who is working on the company work, and the other is a young woman named Hae-jin Yoon from South Korea, who's been working with us. Marcus, incidentally, is an anthropologist, but he's been examining the company data, and this is not published, so what I say is definitely subject to potentially serious revision and interpretation, and you know, still yet to be played out. But I would say, you know, the thing about cities that is so wonderful is that they tend to be very open-ended. They tend to open up. They're very tolerant places. People of all kinds you see in cities, and they're very multidimensional. I mean, the number of different professions, the number of different products increases with city size systematically. And, you know, this is part of the buzz and the excitement of cities and part of their great success. And, you know, just to take, you know, an extreme version of it, cities tolerate crazy people. You know, I mean, you see people that are a little bit on the borders, maybe even homeless people, but people on the borders, and it tolerates crazy ideas. You know, I come from England, and we have the image of Hyde Park Corner. Anyone can get up and speak and say anything. And that's, you know, very emblematic, I think, of what cities are about. You can't usually, and I would say almost ever, have a Hyde Park Corner in a major corporation.
Right, very interesting.
You might at the very beginning of the company, when there's, you know, as you say, three of you or half a dozen of you in the back garage, then kind of anything goes. But very quickly, if you're successful, you have to kind of start buckling down, and you have to have a structure, and you have to have a bureaucracy, and you have to pay your taxes and get the place cleaned and so on. Now, you have to do those in a city too, but cities have, you know, there isn't a profit motive, so to speak, in a city. And this gives it this great sense of freedom. Companies presumably have to have a profit, and this requires certain constraints. And the idea is that maybe having those constraints and having success leads to, instead of increasing dimensionality, decreasing dimensionality, and a little more constrained. So, and when you have less diversity, and this is typical of ecosystems, that's why we're concerned about diversity, is you become more vulnerable. So, you know, cities that are less diverse are more vulnerable, but most importantly, companies that become, you know, uni-product oriented, become very vulnerable, obviously, when the market changes. When, you know, if you're the major producer of horse whips in 1890, you know, you're in trouble.
Right.
You know, and you have to adapt and evolve from that, and most of those companies couldn't.
Now, there's a kind of a... People tend to say things like, it's much harder to have a diverse nation than a nation where everybody has the same basic religion and culture. So if you have a place like Norway, it's easier to run Norway than it is to run the United States because of all the crazy cultural diversity. Why isn't it easier? Why isn't it more adaptive the way an ecosystem that has lots of things going on is more adaptive?
That's an interesting question, and it's not my area of expertise, that's for sure. But, you know, so countries as a whole are obviously this funny tension and balance between having enough diversity in terms of occupations and ideas and so on, really fueling that, getting that interaction to take place. So by diversity here, when I was talking, it was about workplace kind of things, or occupations, or what you're producing, or ideas, diversity of ideas. You're talking about something, a different kind of diversity. It is diversity, and that's to do with culture and race. And, you know, that, as I say, I'm not an expert in, that's for sure, but that is something that we haven't been very good at as human beings. You know, we're not very tolerant of people that are different. We're not very tolerant, usually, of people that are different, but if we're tolerant of people with different ideas and different products and so forth in the marketplace, that turns out to be very good. But somehow we're not also very tolerant of people that look different, you know, either. Presumably in terms of their skin color or their religion or whatever. And, you know, I think one of the exciting things about the end of the 20th century, the beginning of the 21st century, is that we're trying to come to terms with that. And it's not clear we're going to be successful,
right?
Obviously. I mean, you mentioned, or maybe I made it up, Norway or or Holland. You know, I mean, there are two countries, especially Holland, a country I truly admire. I think it's been an extraordinary exemplar of the best in many ways of modern capitalist society in terms of its liberal traditions and its tolerance. And for its size, it's so overperformed, it's absurd. But, you know, it's being sorely tested along exactly this dimension because of the huge influx of people from Muslim countries. But in the past, you know, it had an influx of people from its colonies that it integrated very well. It had large Jewish communities that it integrated well. But this has really pushed it.
Very interesting. We're talking to Jeffrey West. He is a distinguished professor and past president of the Santa Fe Institute. And Science on the Screen, to get back to that, is tonight you will be talking, giving a presentation with film clips called Future Cities Imagined and Real. So there will be all kinds of film clips, and you'll be talking about this. And I was thinking about future cities, putting myself in Renaissance Florence and trying to imagine what, if I was living in, let's say, 1500, you know, a little after the peak of the Florentine Renaissance, imagining what Florence would have been like in the year 2000, you know, 500 years in the future. And it's remarkably similar.
Yes.
And what's amazing is how much cities keep their character.
Yes. No, I think that's true. I think it's kind of amazing that there are some cities that have kept their character extraordinarily well. There's been tremendous resistance, of course, to, you know, the architecture and what that architecture represents in terms of the culture and the soul, so to speak, of the city. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, you have to adapt from walking to and horses to, you know, automobiles and railways and so forth. And, you know, this has been, of course, a huge tension in these more ancient cities.
With their narrow little streets.
With their little streets. And so, whereas America has not had to deal with this problem very much because, except for the obvious cases of some of the East Coast older cities, the cities were already, you know, started to really explode. Of course, they'd already exploded some before the automobile, but the automobile had already really, they were already very well adapted for dealing with it. And also, the amount of horse traffic, horse and carriage traffic, had grown sufficiently that the idea of big boulevards had evolved. I mean, particularly Paris. I mean, there's a city that, you know, we go there and we find it charming and beautiful. But, of course, it's a modern city. If you went back to Paris at the time of medieval Paris or even the Paris of the French Revolution, it wouldn't look anything like the city of Paris today. It was all torn down and rebuilt with these big boulevards, which we love, because there was already the understanding that we needed big boulevards for the large amount of traffic. And so Paris is much more adapted, for example, to the automobile than London, which is, you know, roughly speaking, dysfunctional in terms of its that kind of surface transport.
Can you give us an idea of one or two of the movies from which you'll be showing clips tonight?
Yes, just a few. One, which is kind of extraordinary, many people are familiar with it, is an iconic one from the 20s, metropolis, which I did not appreciate, actually, was kind of the biggest budget movie made up through the into the 30s, actually. It's and it's kind of interesting that the biggest budget movie of that period was focused on cities. And it is it's a feature film. It's not a documentary at all. It's a feature film, and it's very futuristic. And it brings up many of the issues that we deal with today. I'll talk about that a little bit. I will, one of the things I'm really quite pleased about, I'm going to include little clips from the films of Godfrey Reggio, who is local, you know, has a very well-known, distinguished documentary. I guess they're documentaries. I don't know what they're actually technically called, but I think they're not feature films, and they're not exactly documentaries, but they're commentaries. They're powerful social commentaries. One is Koyaanisqatsi, which he made in the 80s, which is the one that was a big hit. And the other one is Anima Mundi. And I will use some of those clips from those.
Excellent. Well, Jeff West, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. Much to talk about. I hope you come back another time soon.
Sure, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.